Welcome to Mid-Century Modernism with Monique, your go-to podcast for all things architecture, design, and innovation within mid-century modernism. Join me on a journey through the golden age of design, where every episode brings you fresh inspiration for modern living and unlocks the secrets of this iconic and timeless style. What are we waiting for? Let's get started. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Mid-Century Modernism with Monique. I'm Monique Anton, your host, and I have with me today my friend, an amazing art collector and furniture collector, Vince Bravo. Hi, Vince.
Hi, Monique.
Vince is not only a collector, but an artist, a preservationist, and he is an expert on Alexander Girard, who we are going to get into in a little bit. But over the years, Vince has really helped a lot of my clients by purchasing furniture that they did not know what to do with. And these are often authentic pieces. And you've actually told us what a lot of these furniture pieces are when we didn't know. But I want to talk about that first. So your store in San Carlos, you have so many amazing antiques and collectibles. Can you share with us a little bit about that? I know you've been doing this for over 30 years, and you started in the 90s. And what has this process been like for you?
Yeah, well, 30 years of experience, it's kind of hard to believe. But in reality, I did start dealing in antiques right out of high school and all through college. While my focus was definitely not as refined as it is now, I really started, you know, buying things like troll dolls and
yes.
Zippo lighters and Levi jeans and Hawaiian shirts and those sort of things. That was really what got me into the business. I also had a massive collection of toasters and chrome appliances. But pretty quickly, I ended up selling in a couple of antique stores and kind of began to refine what I sold to much more mid-century focused.
Mm-hmm. And how do you determine the authenticity of these pieces? You know, a lot of my clients were kind of showing you dilapidated tables and chairs that had been hacked up. I just don't know how you do that so well.
Yeah, well, one of the things in the 90s when I was working in an antique store, we had one of the largest reference libraries there. So books that were being written pre-internet about antiques. And so like you could buy a cookie jar book and you could buy a Victorian furniture book or a sterling silver jewelry book. And so while I helped doing some of that book buying, I spent a lot of time reading those books and looking at all the pictures and always looking at auction catalogs. And since I've always been interested in design, I'm a very visual sort of person. And so once I've seen something, I might not always remember exactly who made it, but I know I've seen it before and I know probably what book it's in and possibly even what's on the page next to it. But over the years, of course, there are some tried and true pieces, you know, that are, you could even say Bay Area focus, you know, that we know that there were showrooms for Ducks Furniture here in the Bay Area. So, you know, if you've got an upholstered chair that looks like Ducks, it might be Ducks because there was a store here. And, Noel and Herman Miller have very iconic sort of furniture that's, after some time, you get to know them.
Absolutely. And you probably have this visual, you know, photographic memory with that too. Are these pieces easy to fix? Are they easy to refinish?
Well, luckily, when I first started buying and selling mid-century furniture, I was focused in on Haywood Wakefield, which is blonde furniture generally, just 50s style. You would look at it and you would say, oh, that's the 1950s. And because Haywood Wakefield's made of solid birch, you can sand it and sand it and sand it and sand it, and you'll have no problem, you know, being able to refinish it. In contrast to that, I can still see myself in the backyard sanding a lane end table for the first time. I fired up the electric sander. I was young. I'd never refinished a lane table before. I didn't even know that lane tables maybe at that time weren't even that popular. And so I hit the sander to it and I went straight through the veneer.
Oh no.
And so I learned pretty quickly, you know, if you're gonna refinish a laying piece, you're probably gonna be using steel wool and a light sandpaper as opposed to electric sander.
Okay, that's good to know. For those of you listening, make a mental note. So I love your website, and I shouldn't have gone on there today because I went on the jewelry section and see a lot of pieces that I really want. I encourage all of you to check out not only the jewelry, but the art, the collectibles, and these pieces are fantastic that you have. I'm not allowed to go on there anymore. How did you get into, now I'm gonna go cross over to Alexander Girard. Mm-hmm. We're gonna talk about him, his amazing interior designs, his architecture, and just this world that he created. What was it first for you that attracted you to this?
Yeah, for Alexander Girard, I had always, or not always, but often had pieces that had his textiles on it, or I knew things related to Girard, but never really focused in on it. There was one or two times where, you know, I was pleased that I found an Eames shell chair that had clean textiles on it. And I just thought, wow, this is cool. You know, the textiles seem great. The upholstery is great. The foam isn't hard. And this is a cool chair. But I never stopped to think, well, where did that upholstery come from? You know, who designed that upholstery? And then I was lucky enough to come across quite a bit of Alexander Girard furniture that really sent me down a rabbit hole of a new appreciation, a new understanding.
Yes.
A new understanding, not only that, like, an Eames chair is also not just Charles Eames, but it's also Ray Eames. And when it has the upholstery, it's also Alexander Girard. And it's probably a lot of other people who helped with that design.
Yes, collaboration.
Exactly.
I love that. Well, his work is the most visually stimulating and appealing work to me. I don't know anything that is more playful, more exciting, more bold, and colorful, to be honest. And these patterns and this work, I think, has trickled down in our culture through so many, you know, fashion, movies. You know, he designed not only textiles and furniture, but he was asked by different, you know, restaurateurs to do the interiors of their restaurants. I know you have two that you know about extensively.
Yeah. So one of the cool things about Girard is that once I started digging into understanding the textiles, I began to understand that he's an architect. He was trained as an architect, a designer, an industrial designer to some degree as well. He's designed some radios as well early on in his career. When he got onto a project, be it a restaurant or a home, he could do everything, you know what I mean? And he did everything. And he was, not only could he do it and did he do it, but he was also interested in all of it. And so he could bring the experience of the textiles, he could bring experience with the furniture, as well as my own passion goes, he brought in his own personal collection. A lot of folk art influenced the work that he did. And so when you look at some of the textiles, you'll see there's reference to Mexican textiles. Some of his tablecloths have references to Eastern European patterns, Scandinavian patterns. And so when we say that the patterns look familiar, they do look familiar because they're culturally familiar.
Yes.
Yeah.
I heard on another interview that you gave for the Museum of Art that you purchased a restaurant tortilla wrapper. I'm amazed that you purchased this from someone who was a collector. Can you share with us this funny story?
Sure.
I love this.
Yeah, well, Girard was hired to decorate La Fonda del Sol in New York, and decorate it he did. Not only was he responsible for selecting the furniture and had Charles Eames design some of the furniture for the restaurant, he also brought in his folk art collection in like the bar. There were these little windows for his folk art to be in the main restaurant as well. He did all the textiles, he did all the wall hangings and stuff. And I quickly have learned that Gerard also designed a lot of the paper goods that go along with everything. And so he designed the matchbooks, the china in the restaurant, always surprising, there's a new thing out there that I've discovered, like the tortilla bag, where I bought this tortilla bag off of a gentleman who went to La Fonda del Sol for, I think he said his 16th birthday, and he saved the tortilla bag. And it's adorable. It has Gerard's son on it. And it also has directions on how to eat a tortilla.
Well, it's funny because modernists, we all share these stories, right? Mm. We are attracted to these wonderful things in life, and they're very small things, but just that inspiration, that nostalgia of that place makes us want to keep these things. So you not only have one, you have two. And there was one other person, right? That had a wrapper.
Uh-huh.
So the fact that there are a lot of us keeping these things and a lot of us drawn to these pieces, I think it's beautiful that in this mid-century modern community, these things are very special to us. And I thank you for keeping these things so, so wonderfully maintained. And I think that you've preserved so much. So I thank you for that. Alexander Gerard, not only was he doing beautiful textiles and patterns, but these fonts have a life of their own. And you were talking about the different fonts in your other interview. I wonder if you could share with us what this means to you, specifically the Herman Miller fonts.
Yeah, so early on in my collecting, I had originally said that I'd never bought paper stuff, which is kind of... it's a bad thing to say, especially for someone who loves design. And now I do like paper stuff because I realized at one point that not only was the paper stuff designed well, but it was also designed by Gerard. And so, for example, the like textile brochure that's really like 16 pages of just type and numbers and words. Yes. You know, I recently found a copy of the first... list of textiles, and included in there was a letter that stated that this packet was designed by Gerard. Uh-huh. And it really was just this very simple, plain, you know, yes, numbers and letters, but he took the time to design it. You know, the fonts that he used were often mirrored of his handwriting as well. I have some, one of his most famous fonts is this kind of swirly, kind of curly cues around the S's and things like that. They used it for textiles. And I've got this great envelope that he wrote his return address on it with that same sort of swirls. And so, you know, it was just, so I think that that's one of those moments where you recognize just how personal design can be, that this is his hand that created it, and then it became really an international marketing tool. The same way I think that textiles that echo Mexican fabrics are from personal experiences of going to the factories in Mexico or seeing those textiles out in public in Mexico.
That's right. And I read that his family, they were in New York and London and all over Europe. His brother was doing ceramics, and you mentioned his name was
Tootsie.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
John Carlo, but they called him Tootsie.
So we were going to talk about Tootsie's ceramics.
Yeah.
And if you have any of those as well.
Yeah, I have a few pieces of them. They are somewhat difficult to find, and the reality is that Herman Miller did distribute them. So there is like a mid-60s catalog that has a whole page of Tootsie's ceramics in it. I think that his ceramics are underexplored at this point, that there's a lot that's not yet known about just how many pieces he made. His niece and nephew talk about visiting there, you know, Alexander Gerard's grandkids talk about visiting the studio in Florence, and when they would go there for the summer, they would have to work. So they would be like moving clay and doing things. So I really think it was a family affair sort of place. The three pieces I have, I've bought from just different people. I think I bought them from dealers, never from, you know, original purchasers.
Yes. And we had met both an original owner, the Scorin House, which was my love, this Don Knorr property in Woodside. We both experienced that house and all of Alexander Girard's artwork there. Can you tell us a little bit about this house? I remember in another interview you gave, you did mention that there were 95 cabinets in textiles in that house. Can you share with us some more?
Yeah, that was a pretty amazing installation, and I would call it an installation or a mural, where this wall covered the dining room, the kitchen, the hallway, and then down into an office. And every square on that wall was a different fabric. It was it was pretty amazing. Checkers and stripes and et cetera. That family also, they were big fans of Tunsi, and so they actually visited Tunsi as well in Florence. I've seen some correspondences between Robert Scorin and Tunsi and about their plans to visit there.
Wow. Yeah. And I remember that ceramic door on the front of the house, just entering that house, and Don Knorr is an amazing architect. These floor-to-ceiling glass walls. It was a very regal house and very exciting from Girard's work. One piece I noted was the eyes. The eyes, I think, are, I don't know if you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they're the most popular design that he had besides the textiles.
Yeah, I mean, Girard's eyes, you know, I think that there's, you know, you can recognize Girard drawn eyes. So like the La Fonda del Sol logo is a sun, but it's not just a sun, it's a sun with a face. And so you see those kind of eyes repeated over and over again. But again, I would say if you have visited, or if when you get a chance to visit the Museum of International Folk Art, you'll see just how much eyes are a part of folk art, either in religious imagery or in, you know, just general folk art. Eyes are, you know, pretty important.
Mm-hmm. And his work with Herman Miller, how would you describe that? What did they do together? You mentioned Charles and Ray Eames had him involved with different chairs and furniture pieces. But what was Herman Miller's focus?
Yeah, so Herman Miller, when they brought on Alexander Girard, they brought him on to specifically George Nelson and Charles Eames. It really encouraged Herman Miller to hire Girard because as they looked out into the textile world of the early 1950s, they weren't pleased with the textiles that they found. And Girard had already made a name for himself in the world of textiles. And so they Herman Miller, you know, was like, okay, well, let's make a textile division. And so realistically, I think a lot of those textiles were initially for in-house use, meaning that like we would, they would create the furniture with that textile on it. But then throughout the 30 years that, or 20 years of being with Herman Miller, he was able to develop really a textile division that brought textiles to the retail world as well.
I love that. And I love that all of these commonplace items, you know, wallpaper, napkins, tablecloths, and you found some ties. Is that correct? How do you find all these things?
Yeah, well, one of the things that I've been able to do is as families are liquidating estates or whatnot, I have bought from a number of Herman Miller, you know, salespeople. And so really these textiles were sold kind of like the traveling salesman or the, you know, the interior design salesman or salesperson who had these books of textiles, you know, and I was lucky enough to buy a pretty extensive collection of samples, and included in there were ties. Actually, I think I might have bought the ties first and then I bought the collection after that.
I love it.
And there was a mystery about like the ties in general and like, you know, could you buy them at the department store? Could you buy them in the store? Were they just for, who were they for? And recently I found a brochure that said that ties were only available for the trade. So only the salespeople could buy the ties.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. Can you imagine if someone came out with this textile in fashion right now, or just put out a lot of ties or even women's suits and men's suits, I think people would go nuts.
Yeah, we are lucky right now that the Girard Estate or the foundation has partnered with a number of textile companies. And so you can buy some shirts made out of Girard fabric, new Girard fabric.
I love that. Where can people buy those?
That's from Gitman Vintage.
Okay.
Yeah, Gitman, I own three of them.
Of course you do. I love that. It just makes life happier. You know,
indeed.
These things are so important. And we will share the website maybe too. We'll put that in notes for those of you listening. And my last, you know, just object of Girard's that I wanted to highlight was these toys and these dolls that he created. What was the story there with that? Such a special thing to create.
Yeah, I think really when to return back to one of the things I said earlier about things being personal, that is really one of those personal objects. That the handmade dolls that he made were personal. They were for the family. They were, you know, now we are lucky enough that those designs are shared through Vitra, through the foundation. You know, they make them, they still hand make them, but they weren't really something that was produced in the period. There's really only one set of them, and then now they recreate them. But I think that that idea of play was always important to mid-century designers, that or product designers. You know, there's a lot of videos and movies that Ray and Charles Eames made that had quite a few toys in them and focused on toys. Girard's folk art collection at times really felt more like a toy collection. Girard's connection to Robert Scorn is toys. That Robert had a huge toy collection, and the two of them wrote a lot about toys and textiles. And so, you know, I think that that's, you know, the really the personal aspect of, you know, the collecting and or the design.
I love when you shared that Robert Scorin was a dentist and had all of these dental tools.
Yeah.
I was impressed at Girard's process of, didn't he ask for these tools?
He did. Yeah, the letter reads something like, rather than just throwing away the tools, you can send them to me.
And what an interesting creative mind to do that and to think of asking for those things.
Indeed.
So there is a book that I wanted to share with you all, too. It's Todd Oldman. Oldham, sorry. It's just called Alexander Girard, the Popular Edition. And you can get that on Amazon. It has many amazing visuals. And you can also check out Vince's website, vincebravo.com, which I am not allowed to go to anymore because I want all the jewelry. But please check that out. And Vince, I cannot thank you enough for your work in this community.
Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Thanks. Thanks for tuning in to today's episode. I hope you had as much fun learning about the world of mid-century modernism as I did. You can also catch the show on my YouTube channel, where we walk through some of the most stylish mid-century modern homes in California. Just search for Mid-Century Modernism with Monique and hit subscribe. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and leave me a comment to let me know what you think. Your feedback helps me make the show even better. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time on Mid-Century Modernism with Monique.